The following Dominican University of California production has been brought to you by radio.dominican.edu.
Well, my name is Denise Lucy, and I'm a professor of business and leadership and the director of our Leadership Institute, which hosts this program with Book Passage. And we've done this now, I think this is our 83rd lecture. Isn't that amazing? 83rd lecture with Book Passage. And I wanted to just say also that this is our 10th year, and I don't know if Isabel remembers this, but the very first lecture we ever did in the Institute for Leadership Studies 10 years ago was with Isabel Allende. It was a small venue, 80 people, and what a wonderful way to launch an institute, right? Who wouldn't want to come to hear Isabel Allende? And they did, and it was a success beyond measure. And we actually talked about our institute's goals, which is to make people better leaders and to affect change in the world, and how we each need to be civically engaged and how we are responsible to do so. And Isabel told a story about what she had been doing in honor of her daughter, which is to have a school to help girls who had been abused in Bangladesh. And it was so powerful, and we were launched. And that is just a thrill for me to say that 10 years, celebrating our 10th year, we have Ms. Allende again. And because of, she's also an alumna, we call her Dr. Allende here, because she has her doctorate from Dominican University, honorary doctorate, and it's just our honor that she is an alumna. I'd like to thank Private Ocean Wealth Management for sponsoring our programs these last three seasons, and all of you Private Ocean supporters and clients, let's please thank Private Ocean Wealth Management for everything they've done for our community. Really, thank them, please. Thank you. Richard Stone is the co-founder and the chairman of Private Ocean, and I'd like to introduce him. His 40-year career is just stellar. He's been recognized in many, many ways. In fact, just recently, he received the Charles Schwab Impact Award for leadership in lifetime contributions to the field of financial planning. And he also, he's just been a great friend and supporter. He's on our board, actually. He's the chair of our finance committee, and aren't we in good hands? May I introduce Mr. Richard Stone.
Our guest tonight, Isabel Allende, is no stranger to Dominican. This is the third time the New York Times bestselling author has appeared on campus in this wonderful lecture series. We're grateful and fortunate she chooses our lecture series. We're grateful and fortunate she keeps writing incredible novels. Beginning with her first bestselling novel, The House of Spirits, published in 1982, Isabel has authored 20 books that have been translated into 35 languages and sold more than 60 million copies. Two of her books have been turned into international movies. Her works of fiction and nonfiction are celebrated throughout the world. She's a recipient of several awards, including the John Steinbeck Prize, the Hans Christian Andersen Prize, and 14 honorary degrees from national and international universities, including Dominican University. Furthermore, Isabel is universally admired for her devotion to human rights. Following the death of her beloved daughter, Paula, in 1992, Isabel created the Isabel Allende Foundation, dedicated to the protection and empowerment of women and children worldwide. Isabel, who once wrote a series of children's books, brings to us her first detective mystery. In Ripper, she has penned a novel about a San Francisco serial crime, using her characters to magically weave a fast-paced, suspenseful tale through people and their relationships. This book is available in both English and Spanish. Ms. Allende will be conversational with a successful lawyer and civic activist turned mystery writer, Willie Gordon. Mr. Gordon has published four mysteries, beginning with his smash hit, The Chinese Jars. All are published in Spanish and English. His work has been widely received. He is also Isabel's husband. Please welcome Ms. Allende and Willie Gordon.
Thanks a lot. Thank you. Gracias. It's wonderful. I have all my family and friends here. Is there anybody in the audience who is not my personal friend? You see?
I'm announcing my retirement tonight. Isabel, I was thinking back to 8th of January 2013 when you showed me...
2012.
Who's giving this talk?
You or me? He doesn't get anything right. It's just terrible. I wrote the book in 2012, Willie.
All right. Can we start over? Anyway, you brought the few pages that you'd written to me, and I read them over, and I said, gee, this is really a beautiful description of San Francisco. Where the hell's the dead body? You can't have a mystery without a dead body on the first page. So why don't you read to the audience what you put down after that?
Yeah. This is the beginning of the book. I will skip the first paragraph because I don't want to ruin it for you. Let me see if I can get this thing. Okay. They refer to the first murder as the case of the misplaced baseball bat, so as not to insult the victim by giving it a more explicit name. There were five teenagers and an elderly man who met up online to play a role-playing game called Ripper. The game master was a girl called Amanda Martin. The kids who played Ripper were a select group of freaks and geeks from around the world who had first met up online to hunt down the mysterious Jack the Ripper. As game master, Amanda was responsible for plotting these adventures, carefully bearing in mind the strengths and weaknesses of the alter egos created by the players. At 17, Amanda was idiosyncratic of appearance, shy of character, and magnificent of mind. She was dreadfully spoiled and vegetarian, only because she didn't have to cook for herself. When she was forced to do so, she would be less pernickety about her diet. Her addiction to horrid Scandinavian crime novels developed naturally into a morbid interest in evil in general and premeditated murder in particular. On the morning of October 13, the fourth grade students of Golden Hill School raced into the gym to whistle blast from their coach in the doorway. Normally, they would run two laps around the basketball court to warm up, but this morning, they came to a shuddering halt, shocked by the grisly sight of a man sprawled across a vaulting horse, his pants pulled around his ankles, his buttocks bared, and the handle of a baseball bat inserted into his rectum.
There's your murder.
He didn't come up with that idea. Everybody thinks it's Willie's idea. It isn't. The stunned children stood motionless around the corpse until one 9-year-old boy bent down and ran his finger through the dark stain on the floor and realized that it was not chocolate, but congealed blood. A second boy picked up a spent bullet cartridge and slipped it into his pocket, intending to swap it during recess for a porn magazine, while a girl filmed the scene on her cell phone. Just then, the coach bounded over to the group of students, whistle trilling with every breath, and seeing this strange spectacle, suffered a panic attack. The fourth graders raised the alarm, and other teachers quickly appeared and dragged the children and the hysterical coach from the gym. The teachers removed the baseball bat, and as they laid the corpse on the floor, they noticed a bullet hole in the center of the victim's forehead. They covered the body with a pair of sweatpants, closed the door, and waited for the police, who arrived precisely 19 minutes later, by which time the crime scene had been so completely contaminated, it was impossible to tell what the hell had happened. Thanks. Today I was on the radio and with Michael Krasny, and a person called in and said, Can I read this book as a family reading with my 10-year-old kid? And Michael Krasny said, I don't think so.
Well, it's true that I didn't give her that idea, but a couple of years ago I was having a fight with another attorney on the phone, and she was listening, and I got so mad at the guy, I said, just shove it up your ass. Now, I don't know.
Willie, this is the Dominican nuns in this school.
Hi, Sister Gervais, where are you? Now, Isabel, this is really a departure from one of the many genres that you've already written about. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? Because it's pretty phenomenal that you would try this from scratch and just make this wonderful novel. What is it about you that allows you to...
I'm a good writer.
Yeah.
I'm a very good writer. Well, and I have been sleeping with you for 26 years, so we only talk about murder at home. I mean, about food and murder, that's it. Well, so after so many years, I think it got into me by osmosis or something.
Wait a minute. I wrote my first book was about an oversexed dwarf, and you told me it was the worst piece of crap you'd ever read.
It was terrible. It was terrible.
So my
you know, he retired. He retired years and years ago. Yeah. And when he retired, he said, I want to write a novel. I said, what? Are you going to compete with me? And he said, no, all my life I have thought that when I retire, I will write a novel. And I said, okay, when I retire, I will practice law. Well, and then he started writing, and you came up with that horrible book. Horrible book.
But my third book is about the oversexed dwarf, so I won that battle.
But in that first book, you had put everything plus the oversexed dwarf. It was just awful. So I told him, I mean, no woman in her right mind would sleep with this creature, this horrible creature. And I gave you the idea to write mysteries.
That's true, you did.
He was very depressed after I said that the novel was crappy.
Right.
He was very, very depressed, and we were holding hands in bed, and he was almost crying. And I said... And I said, Willie, why don't you write mysteries? I mean, you've lived at the edge of the law all your life, and you've lived surrounded by criminals. This is what you should write about.
You know how she said I lived on the edge of the law.
I know.
Thanks a lot, Emma. this isn't about me. Let's talk about the research that you did to write this book. Can you do something?
Yeah. First, I have to say that you don't research. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so the idea was that we were going to write...
In the interest of full disclosure.
Yeah.
Lived it.
We were going to write this book together. But then I realized that we have very different styles. I write in Spanish. He writes in English. Mm-hmm. He writes for 11 minutes at a time. I write for 11 hours. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't research. And I really research. But in this case, I want to thank a few people, but especially Sarah. Where's Sarah? There is Sarah. Sarah is my researcher. She helped me. She helped me find, I would say, Sarah, I have a kidnapped person. 10 days kidnapped. Where can I hide it? Hide that person in the Bay Area so that she will not be found? The next day, she would come with a perfect hiding place. I would say, I need to talk to a Navy SEAL. Next day, she had a Navy SEAL willing to talk. I mean, it was just amazing. Thank you, Sarah. And many other people helped me. So I did part of the research myself, but really, the only research I did was all concentrated at the Mystery Writers Conference in Book Passage. You can ask anything you want there, and there's a wonderful faculty that will give you ideas and help you and give you a list of things to read. And then when the book was ready, I called Dr. Lyle, who is a forensic doctor, and I talked with him on the phone, and I asked, because I write in Spanish, I couldn't send him the manuscript. So I talked to him, and he helped me a lot. But what helped a lot also was the questions of the students, remember?
Yeah, yeah.
For example, the students would ask the faculty, if I inject a blood thinner to the victim and I stab her 13 times and hang her upside down in the shower, would the blood congeal in the bathtub? I mean, with that kind of question, I don't need to stress my imagination. I just copied the questions, and there they are.
Tell a little bit about the dog, because that's a very interesting play in this book. Where did you get the idea for that?
Well, dog? I just love dogs, you know. Mm-hmm. We have two rescues that we adore. Mm-hmm. And in many of my books, I have dogs. In The House of the Spirits, I have a dog called Barabbas, a very big dog. And there are several students' theses about this dog, what that dog means, what if the dog is a metaphor for something. For example, the male energy in the house, black and threatening, or the people that will be stepped over by the dictatorship. It was just a dog that I had in my house, that we had at the house. Nothing but a dog. And so in this case, I also have a dog in Maya's notebook. But in this case, I have an Navy SEAL.
That was the fucking dog?
That was the fucking dog, oh. Yeah. Yeah, the fucking dog. Oh, God. That brought me a lot of trouble. Willie, when he walks our dogs in the park, and the dogs don't come, he yells in the park in front of all the little children, "Come here, you fucking dog!" And all the mothers complain, and it's just a horrible. So I had a dog called Fucking in Maya's notebook. And in this case, I have this Navy SEAL who had been wounded in the war, and he had a dog, a war dog. And I researched about the war dogs, and it's the most interesting thing. In Afghanistan and Iraq alone, the United States has 2,300 war dogs with titanium fangs and wars that are trained to kill. But they have one handler that is like their companion, and they are all the time only with that person. They're very fierce dog and very intelligent. So I have one of those dogs that has been wounded also, and is as traumatized as the Navy SEAL, and they are companions. Never in the book I say that Attila was the Navy SEAL's dog, because he doesn't belong to anybody. They are together.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your descriptions of San Francisco, and I want to know especially about the protagonist, the woman healer. Where did you get that idea?
You know where I got her. You know where I got her. Well, Willie was diagnosed 3 years ago with some kind of terminal disease. He should be dead.
Yeah.
But he's... Well, now they say that it was misdiagnosed, because when the doctors have not invented the medication, then it was misdiagnosed. But we had a very good friend who is a healer from Argentina, and she has been treating Willie and other people as well, acupuncturists and even psychics, astrologers, you name it. And he's doing fine. And so in the book, I have a holistic clinic, and I have a healer, Indiana, who is my protagonist's mother. And she is this tall, blonde, sexy, lovely woman. Everybody's in love with her, and she's very naive and quite a hippie. And people say, where did you get her? Well, physically, she is who I would like to be. I would love to be like that. But the idea of the aromatherapy and Reiki and all those things, I got it from Ana Cejas, yeah. Our friend in Argentina. Sometimes it's so much easier to write a book if you have a model, someone that mm-hmm. can that you can observe and mm-hmm. just suck their blood.
Okay, well, I just have one more question here, and I want to know, how did San Domenico get so involved in this book?
In the book?
Yes.
Well, my two granddaughters went to San Domenico, mm-hmm. a school that mm-hmm. we love, absolutely love. And we love the nuns mm-hmm. because they are so special and so liberal mm-hmm. and so intelligent. And they're always against the Pope. Well, not against this Pope, but against all the other popes. They're just fantastic people. So, yes. And so in this book, I have my sleuth, Amanda Martin, the daughter of the chief of homicide. She is at San Domenico, and she's a boarder there, and so she can't investigate. She's also very young, she's only 16. And her grandfather helps her with the investigation. Her grandfather is her henchman. And they have a wonderful relationship. You know, all my books are about people and relationships. And this book is just about that, but I threw in a few corpses. That's what you said when you read the manuscript.
That's good. Well, let's...
Why don't we open it to questions from the audience? Elaine has some questions.
Or just ask me.
You know, it's...
So the first person who says that she writes first in Portuguese wants to know, do you write always in Spanish? Do you write sometimes in English? How does that work?
No, I write fiction only in Spanish. I have answered this question 200 times at least in the last 24 hours. This book should have been written in English because it happens in San Francisco to American characters, and all the research was in English that I had to translate into Spanish. And then the translators had to put it back into English. So it should have been done in English, but I just can't write in English. I have tried, and then Willie says, no, it's not working. This is not working. It doesn't sound English.
Well, those of us who
I think that I speak English, he thinks that he speaks Spanish.
Perfect couple.
And you know, when we fight, I speak in English so very slowly so that he will understand. And he replies in Spanish very slowly so I will get it. And we make love in English? No, in Spanish. Okay. Don't be shy, it doesn't matter. I mean, I think it's wonderful that at our age we can still do it, don't you think? Not very often, but...
Almost a miracle.
Almost a miracle.
Good. Willie, there's a question for you. Someone has asked, has said that your books have been referred to here. Are they available in languages other than English or just English?
Well, they're available in English, Spanish, French, Portuguese, Romanian, Polish, and Italian.
So,
and Dutch.
But
that's the first one. Then I stopped answering the mail for the second one.
But you know, having read your books, I have a follow-up question to that, which is, you know, they're very American in many ways. I know the one that's coming out in April, and their earlier one, The Chinese Jars, set in Chinatown. Mm-hmm. Do people get it when they're in Romania? How does that work?
I have no idea.
I know you tour to all these places. I was actually thinking of you last night because I was watching Pussy Riot on Colbert.
Oh,
and
yeah.
They had a translator, and I was thinking of the two of you going to other countries and having to have everything translated for you, and it seems to me to be...
Well, Isabel, they do a wonderful job in translation in the English part of hers, but in my things, I have the Spanish translation from Spain, and that doesn't really go over so well in Latin America because... For instance, a bum in Spain is a gilipolla, and people make fun of me for using the word, and I say, I didn't use the word, they use it in Spain, and it's stuff like that that you can never get it exactly straight, so I don't know.
Well, when I met Willie, he spoke Spanish like a Mexican bandido, and...
I still do.
That is absolutely true. And with me, I gave him class, and I taught him decent Spanish.
Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, remember that?
And I got rid of his tattoos.
She gave him sex appeal, and he gave her style.
Class.
Let's get serious here. I have several questions from people who would like to know about writing and whether you ever teach writing. And I'm particularly taken with a question about a daughter who's 19 years old and a sophomore at Pitzer, a college we love, studying liberal arts and hoping to be a writer. What advice would you give her?
Well, I always say that this is like training for sports. You have to do it every single day and nobody sees the training. But you have to really write and read. This has to be a passion. But I heard Elizabeth Gilbert say something wonderful in New York. And I was in a book tour and I was paired with her. And somebody from the audience asked that question. And she said, don't expect your art to support you or to make you famous. You do it because if you don't do it, your soul will be so burdened that you will not be able to go on with your life. And I think it's such a wonderful answer, because if you are expecting to write the great American novel and be rich and famous, it's not going to happen. You still have to do it.
I remember hearing Ann Patchett talking on the radio, she said that when she was young, she just whipped out the details for the magazine articles, and then when she decided that she was going to become a professional writer, she realized that the inspiration was gone. She just had to sit down every day and do it. So, as Isabel says,
yeah,
write every day.
If the inspiration will come, it better find you working.
Yeah.
That's a good line.
But there must, I've had a couple questions here, that there must be ups and downs emotionally when you're writing, where you feel you're not getting anywhere, nothing's happening. How do you handle all of that? Or maybe it never happens.
I get up, because I can only do it for 11 minutes.
And I just keep going. And I have had writer's block only once after Paula died. And I gave myself a task to write a nonfiction book about something that would have nothing to do with grief and loss and death and tears. And I wrote a nonfiction book about lust and gluttony. The sisters, the only sins that are worth the trouble.
Mm-hmm. Well, my son died last year, and I had a writer's block off and on for most of the year. And I'm not through it yet, so I don't know the answer. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you get through that, but I've tried to sit down and start writing again. So it's tough, as Isabel says.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, sometimes life seems so dark, mm-hmm, that it's very hard to find the calm, the peace, the energy to create anything, let alone writing. Because in the process of writing, even if you're writing a book like Ripper, you are raw. It comes from here. And it's such a raw and intimate process that it's very hard to do it when you are grieving the way that, mm-hmm, we both have been grieving so many times. We have had a life, a wonderful life together, that has ups and downs, like most lives. A lot of tragedy and a lot of love and success and good things. And when the dark times come, we tell each other, remember, it will not last more than 2 years. We have the idea that good and bad last 2 years. In 2 years, everything changes. And 2 years at a time, we've been together for 26.
Thank goodness you're together. Now, Isabel, you start writing a book every 8th of January, and that's when I know that I will only see you a little bit late in the afternoon. But Isn't that putting a lot of pressure on yourself? Several people want to know, how do you make yourself do that? How do you know there's a book on the 8th of January?
Well, maybe there isn't, but if I don't have a day to begin, I would be procrastinating forever. I mean, it's very, very difficult to make the decision of locking yourself in a room for days and weeks and months until you finish a book. Is the passion and the energy going to last the whole journey, or it's only at the beginning and then you won't have it? It's always a full commitment, like falling in love. So I don't know if it's going to happen or not, but I have to give it a chance. So January 8th is a good date for me to start. And I keep telling Willie, you should have a date to start and you should have a schedule. You can't be writing 11 minutes at a time. I mean, he does everything 11 minutes at a time. Even that.
Well, it must work. I just read Willie's book that's coming out in April, and it's terrific.
That's just imagination.
You mean he didn't research all that?
Well, I don't know if he researched with somebody else.
Her idea of research and mine are different.
He thinks that Google is research.
No. Well, Willie, you write about the law, and so you've done that research.
And life.
Right.
Your husband, Bill Petrocelli, who's also a writer of some renown in later years, we were talking about this just this evening, and he said, you know, sometimes things just kind of fall in your lap, and that's true, because life experience is one of the really important things in a writer's life, and you don't have to reach out and grab the fruit that's up there. You can get the low-hanging fruit, and it just falls in your lap, and that's your life experience helps you do that. So I rely on that. And next year when I've exhausted it, I'll sit down for 11 hours and struggle.
Here's someone who's already read your book, Ripper, and she is asking, I think it's a she, she says she enjoyed the movie of House of the Spirits and of Love and Shadows, but as she was reading Ripper, she couldn't wait for the film. Is there anything planned?
Actually, the book just came out a week ago, and I already have three producers that are interested in the movie. But Hollywood, I mean, they want everything. We spent 4 years and a huge amount of money in lawyers studying the contract for Daughter of Fortune, and at the end I couldn't sign it because they give you a telephone book this thick, that's the contract, and with very small writing, and they want the rights to do anything, not only the movie, any other product that they come up with for the universe, and the universe to be discovered. I'm not making this up.
No.
This is what the contract says, Mars, whatever. With the technology that exists and the technology to be invented forever. It has no limit in time. Plus, they want the copyright of the characters. So if I use my own characters for another book, I have to pay them a royalty. I can't sign that.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
But
I asked Elizabeth Gilbert, how did you get your movie done? And she said, I didn't read the contract.
Clearly not married to a lawyer. Maybe there are disadvantages there. I believe, an opera that is being that you're working on. Could you talk a little bit about the opera?
Well, there was an opera called Dulce Rosa that was premiered in Los Angeles. Placido Domingo directed it, with one of my short stories. And it was very successful and very beautiful, that's the truth. And now they want me to write a second one. And I sort of did, but Placido Domingo said that didn't sound like an opera. So, okay, I'll try something else, but you will have to wait.
Well, that brings us to this question, which is, are you planning to continue your autobiographical works where you left off? And some of us would like to know more about Placido Domingo.
About what?
That wasn't in the question, but I added it.
Yeah. I have written two memoirs that involve my family, and I don't think it's fair to them. Now that I look back, at the moment it seemed very appropriate, but now I look back and I one of the problems with the memoir is that people become frozen in a book. So a person, I mean, for example, my grandchildren, I described them when they were little, and now they're adults, they're all in college, and they are sort of frozen forever.
Oh, wait a minute. They're not adults, they're in college.
Yeah, that's true.
We have quite a few people in that category here today.
But you know, I keep telling Willie that he should write a memoir because
yes.
When I met Willie many, many years ago, he invited me out for dinner. And I had just divorced my previous husband. I had been celibate for a long time. And 2 or 3 weeks, I think. And so I said, okay, we went out for dinner, and he started telling me the story of his life. And I said, it's wonderful, somebody should write this story. And he said, I'm planning to write it someday. And I said, why don't you let me write it? I will do a better job. And he was very generous and gave me his life, and I wrote The Infinite Plan. But that was many, many years ago. And The Infinite Plan is fiction. I think that you should write a memoir because you have had a life that is pretty unbelievable. And the things that have happened to you, good and bad, I mean, just being married to me is wonderful. Yeah,
that's the good part.
That's the good part, yeah.
Will you have editorial rights when somebody writes about you?
I'm not, he never had, I mean, I gave him the manuscript to read of those two memoirs. He never objected to anything and always was very supportive of everything I wrote and everything I did. And when I said, Willie, don't you feel that we might be very exposed, that that would make us very vulnerable? And Willie said, it is not the truth we tell that makes us vulnerable, but the secrets we keep.
Oh, lovely. That's beautiful. With that wisdom, I think...
So that would be a project that we could do together because it doesn't need any research. It could be written in Spanglish.
You know...
And we got...
You know how this book started? Her agent, who... Isabel sells more books than all the other big shots in the Latin language and the Spanish language put together, and her agent is now in her 80s, and her financial pipeline is Isabel Allende. And Isabel said she was going to retire. So she came up with this idea that Isabel and I should write a book together. And that lasted about a week because, Jesus Christ, you can't even believe it.
What?
She is so bossy.
I'm very professional.
And then she said I would have to work at least 10 hours a day, you know, when I can do it for 11 minutes. As a matter of fact, I've been here for longer than 11 minutes.
Well, I think we'd like to see that memoir and see if you can manage through it together.
I don't think so.
I do have to tell people that Isabel talked about her book that she wrote about lust. And that some of the people in the audience, I think maybe you, Denise, were invited to a dinner party that she gave, and she told all of us that what we were eating was aphrodisiac, and that we should call her in the morning and tell her if it worked. And then years later, she told me, oh, I just made that up.
So, no, you know, I was really lucky because I published that book about aphrodisiacs 4 months before Viagra was released in the market. Otherwise, I would have sold one copy of the book. It's much easier to take a pill than to read the book.
The book's much better, I'm sure.
I don't think so.
Well, thank you both for...
Why? What are you laughing at? It never worked.
Yeah. What, Viagra or the book?
No, the book. It never works. I mean, I tried all the recipes and... You know, aphrodisiacs are like black magic. If you tell a person that the person is a victim of black magic, they get really ill and they might even die. The same with aphrodisiacs. If you tell them that the food they have eaten is aphrodisiac, oh, they are aroused immediately. If you don't tell them anything, it doesn't have any effect. It's all in the mind.
This is the influence this woman has on the world. Thank you both for being so open and bringing us so much, and to both of you for the books that you write. And if you haven't read Ripper yet, because you've only had it for about half an hour, actually an hour, you've had it for an hour now, call me when you've read it, because I think you're going to have a lot to talk about. Thank you both so much for this.
Thank you very, very much.
Just one quick thing. This event was videoed. Believe it or not, this will be out on the web. You will be able to find it on both the Dominican site and on the Book Passage site in a very few days. And so if you know anyone who missed it, or if you want to hear them say again the things you can't believe they said, then go online and watch it again. Thanks so much.
Fresh, edgy, energetic, smart, sometimes crazy, but always real. It's happening here on Penguin Radio at radio.dominican.edu.